I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said today he thought information in the 92,000 classified military reports released by his website could lead to war crimes. Another 15,000 documents will be released after the website volunteers redact the names of people whose safety might be at risk. The documents cover much of what is known about the 9-year war, that civilians were killed, that the Pakistan Intelligence Service may be working with the Taliban, something Pakistan officials today vehemently deny. But three major newspapers were given access to the documents several weeks ago and released articles yesterday, perhaps the largest unauthorized disclosure in U.S. military history. So let's hear more about how it happened. Clint Hendler covers WikiLeaks for the Columbia Journalism Review. Clint, WikiLeaks made news back in April for releasing that 2007 video of that helicopter attack in Iraq that killed a dozen civilians. The U.S. military criticized WikiLeaks for taking the footage out of context, and they charged Army intelligence analyst Bradley Manning with leaking that classified material. Do we know if he's behind this leak?
No, we don't. And we don't know if Manning was responsible for the other leak. We just know he's been charged.
Right. Well, and what we also do know that another hacker, Adrian Lamo, traded instant messages with Manning, in which Lamo says that Manning claimed to have leaked things to Wikipedia. It was hacker Adrian Lamo who first turned Manning over to authorities. And it's interesting to us because, you know, this is a hacker, and the founder of WikiLeaks is also said to be a former hacker.
Well, he's not just said to be a hacker. He was found guilty of that in an Australian court, and he's really made no secret of it. He was quite a prominent hacker in the 90s. I know, relatively harmless, but definitely intrusive hacks in Australia. Assange, you know, he's an Australian citizen, but is these days a little bit rootless. He supposedly makes a home in Africa. A little bit of a mysterious character. He's hard to get a hold of, prone to making grandiose statements about WikiLeaks' role in fostering transparency. But, you know, over the last 3 years, WikiLeaks has compiled quite a track record of releasing interesting documents that governments, corporations, and others would prefer not coming to light.
Yeah, tell us some of the other leaks that have occurred. It's not just U.S. military.
No, absolutely not. WikiLeaks posted a set of climate emails, emails dealing with scientists who study climate change out of the UK. They've done a lot of work in Africa, perhaps reflecting, you know, Assange's connections and time on the continent. Swiss bank records. The list really goes on and on.
Well, the New York Times is reporting that U.S. officials now believe that Private Manning might have exploited a loophole in Defense Department security to copy thousands of files onto compact disks and maybe leak them. Is WikiLeaks itself in any legal danger?
Probably not. I mean, the United States has pretty robust laws protecting newspapers who want to publish classified information.
We mentioned that WikiLeaks is holding back documents as they redact some names. What does that tell you about WikiLeaks and how it may be evolving?
That's a great question. You know, WikiLeaks started off, you know, look at the name, Wiki. It started off being inspired by Wikipedia. It was going to be the sort of site where users could post documents more or less automatically and then have a ongoing process where other readers could go through and sort of say what the documents meant in significance, whether or not they thought they were, you know, true. But more and more so, WikiLeaks has been doing more editorial work behind the scenes before release. You certainly saw that with the video before where WikiLeaks, you know, actually sent journalists to Iraq to do some background research and produced a video with a lot of, you know, on-screen sort of text narration. In this case, WikiLeaks says that they've decided to hold back a lot of documents in part because of the request of their source. But the spirit behind that request, and apparently it's one that WikiLeaks, you know, says it agrees with, is that some of these documents could put innocent lives at risk and that they don't want to be a part of that. So they're starting to act, in this case, much more like a traditional news organization in terms of keeping an eye on what portions of classified documents are too sensitive to be released.
It's interesting that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange says his whole goal is transparency, but the organization itself isn't very transparent.
That's true. We don't know a lot of things about it. We don't know how many people actually work for it. We don't know the true identities. You know, Julian Assange is a public face of the organization, but we know very, very few of other true identities of people who are intimately involved in the operations of WikiLeaks. It's a sort of catch-as-catch-can organization, makes a lot of use of volunteers scattered around the world, many of whom remain anonymous.
Clint Hendler has reported on WikiLeaks for the Columbia Journalism Review. Clint, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So once again, Afghanistan lurches into the headlines. The stories seem to come in spasms now. Remember, it was just last month when General Stanley McChrystal was fired as top commander after he and his aides made disparaging remarks about President Obama and civilian leaders in Rolling Stone magazine. And it was interesting to read last week that in his final hours on the job, McChrystal took time to send a thank you note to Greg Mortensen. Greg Mortensen has described himself as the mountaineer who took a wrong turn in Pakistan. Remember, in 1993, he was taken in by villagers. He thanked them by building a school. He went on to build more than 130, mostly for girls, in some of the most remote parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan, work he wrote about in his bestseller, Three Cups of Tea. Well, we weren't surprised to hear that he had advised Stanley McChrystal. Last year, Greg Mortensen dropped by our studios as the Obama administration was deciding to send more troops to Afghanistan and told us then the military had been in touch.
About a year and a half ago, I started getting contacted by the U.S. military. A lot of military wives are actually reading the book and telling their husbands to check it out. I got an email from General Petraeus, who's our CENTCOM commander. He said he had read Three Cups of Tea, and he sent me three bullet points. This is what he learned from the book. Number one, build relationships. Number two, have respect. And number three, that we need to listen to people. We need to listen. In many ways, our military commanders, they've been in Afghanistan three or four times, and they really get it that what is most important is to build relationships. So mostly what I talk about, I do this all as a volunteer. I'm not getting paid or anything, to tell them about cultural sensitivity and also about the significance of what education can do. I'll quote to you an Army colonel. His name is Colonel Kalenda, commander of the forward operating base in Kunar province in Afghanistan. He says that ultimately this is a war that will not be won with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity.
It's so funny you mention Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Kalenda, who works on the front lines there in Afghanistan, because I was just picking up a paper with a quote from him in which he raves about your book and your work. And he also says, I'm convinced the long-term solution to terrorism in general and Afghanistan especially is education. You are getting all of these accolades, all of these office doors in Washington opening to you. You're very modest, so I'll say it. Several congressmen have nominated you for the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that you've done. And yet, Greg, we understand the Obama administration is planning a sharp troop increase in Afghanistan and also switching their strategy from butter to guns, from reconstruction and rebuilding to fighting the Taliban.
President Obama is actually already in the process of rapidly deploying three brigades to Afghanistan, 20 to 30,000 troops, which is about 60% increase in our troop strength. I've talked to our top military commanders, spent a lot of time with them, and even they will tell you there is no military solution in Afghanistan. That's absolutely not possible. What I think our administration is thinking about is what I call firepower. But if you talk to our military leaders, they say the people there need brain power. And brain power means training, supplies for their army, for their police, but mostly education. And also having met with President Karzai, their top military commanders in Afghanistan, their militia leaders, their Islamic leaders, they will all say, we do not need more U.S. troops in Afghanistan. What we need is training, supplies, and we need education. So my concern is that Obama has rather brazenly announced this without consulting with the Afghan people first. On the other hand, our military leaders, like, say, Admiral Mike Mullen, Eric Olson, who's a Special Forces commander, and General Petraeus, the three of them combined have been to Pakistan and Afghanistan about 20 times in the last 10 months. What they are doing is they're drinking tea, as in my case, and they're meeting with the people, they're listening to them, and that's really the key to, I think, peace.
Explain what the drinking tea analogy is, because you had a lot of setbacks in your dream of building schools because you didn't understand what the need really was. And in that first town I mentioned, Corfay, after they nursed you back to health, you came home, you desperately tried to raise the money, you sent out over 500 fundraising letters, you got one check back from Tom Brokaw, you finally got some money to go build them a school, and you get all the equipment and you get over the mountain passes and you've got all of this stuff to build a school for them, and they greet you and say, but what we really need is a bridge.
Well, Haji Ali was a village chief in a village in northern Pakistan, and he told me once, I'd spent 3 years trying to get a school built. And my problem was I was doing something that we call micromanagement. I had my plumb line receipts, and I was determined to get this school built. One day, Haji Ali took me aside. He said, if you want to do business here, you need to have three cups of tea. First cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a friend. And third cup, your family. What he was meaning is that it's important to build relationships. And not only that, he took my plumb line receipts and records. He locked them up. He came back and said, there, everything will be fine. Don't you worry.
This is all the equipment you had bought, your plumb line and,
right,
and all the receipts and everything to build the school. He finally took them away from you, and you panicked.
I panicked, and guess what happened? 6 weeks later, the school got built, and it was an important lesson to let go and empower the communities, and that is kind of the key to all our schools now. We provide skilled labor, material, and teacher training, but they provide free land, free resources, free wood, and free sweat equity. And that's on a micro scale, but you can also apply this on a macro scale. One of my main criticisms about the reconstruction policy in Afghanistan until recently is that it was primarily centralized and deprovincialized. And if you look back in history at the Marshall Plan was provincialized and decentralized. And so in Afghanistan, until recently, we completely flipped that around. And only recently have we really started to realize about empowering provincial areas. And it's basically, I call it bottoms-up type of development.
Well, Greg Mortensen, it sounds like I'm hearing you say a couple of important things here. One is that there seems to be a disconnect. You're hearing from people in the military, gee, we're really on board with what this Mortensen guy is saying. We need to build these schools. This is the way we need to go. And yet we're hearing from the Obama administration they're going to pull back from reconstruction and attack the Taliban. But you're also saying that when there is reconstruction through the military, it tends to be without involving the people who actually are going to use facilities like schools. So let's address each of those. The Taliban has been so resurgent. Don't you have to tamp down the Taliban first before you can build schools?
Well, certainly there's need for security. There's need to secure areas. There are two things going on. One is that the Taliban have bombed, destroyed, or shut down over 500 schools in Afghanistan, another 180 schools in Pakistan. But nearly all those schools are girls' schools. And I think the real reason they're attacking girls' schools and not boys' schools is because their greatest fear is not the bullet, but it's the pen. And what they fear most is if that girl grows up, gets an education, they've lost the ability to get recruits. In the Quran, it mentions that when someone goes on jihad, they first have to get permission from their mother. And if they don't, it's very disgraceful. If a woman has an education, she's much less likely to condone her son to get into violence or terrorism. On the other hand, this is something I find very incredible, is that there are today over 7 million children in school in Afghanistan. 2 million are female. And in 2000, 8 years ago, there's only 800,000, mostly boys, in school. It's the largest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history, and nobody in the U.S. is aware of it.
That's Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea. We spoke with him last year. We'll have more after a break. Also today, how about using rewards, carrots, along with sticks, regulations, to prevent another oil disaster? That's later, but back in 1 minute with Greg Mortensen, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. A spokesperson for President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan today says terrorism in Afghanistan will not be defeated unless we pay attention to the places where terrorism is nurtured. The spokesperson was referring to those documents on WikiLeaks that allege Pakistan's intelligence service may have been working with the Taliban. But today we're listening to Greg Mortensen, who says the way to defeat terrorists is through education. And the U.S. military has been paying attention to him. His first bestseller about building schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan is called Three Cups of Tea. His argument against a military solution in the region is summed up in the title of his newest book, Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We spoke with Greg Mortensen last year. Since then, he's set up some 36 meetings between tribal leaders and U.S. military leaders, including the since-replaced General Stanley McChrystal. When we spoke with Greg last year, we'd been reading about Taliban attacks against girls' schools, including acid thrown in girls' faces. Now, before the break, I've been asking Greg if news like that means we do need the military to tamp down the Taliban so schools can work.
In some areas, obviously, the military is going to have to take on the Taliban. But, for example, the way we get girls' school started in Taliban areas is we work many years building relationships. We also meet with the Taliban in some cases. And we have former Taliban who now are teachers in our schools, and they are our greatest advocates for education. And all of them got out of the Taliban because their mother said, what you're doing is not a good thing. And they're at risk for their life. They're on a hit list. But they're willing to be advocates for education. And what happens is when a school is destroyed, it's often written off the government records. But if you go back there 6 months, 1 year later, you'll still see the girls outside or in secrecy trying to go to school. And unfortunately, nobody's really supporting that effort. The girls themselves, their communities, they value education. And that's what I find everywhere I go in rural Pakistan, Afghanistan. People really, really want education.
In fact, the New York Times has an anecdote about an attack, an anti-American mob in Baharak, Afghanistan, rampaging through but stopping at the school. I think you built that school.
Yeah, we built a school in Baharak in northern Afghanistan on May 13th, Friday the 13th, 2005. The story came out with Newsweek that there was an alleged story of a Quran being flushed in the toilet in Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. And riots erupted and ensued everywhere, and Baharak was no exception. About 2,000 men went down the streets after Juma Friday prayers. They destroyed every single NGO office, the Land Cruisers, their computers. And the last school in the end of the bazaar, 2 miles down the road, was our beautiful brand new school with fresh green lime paint, fresh window panes. I mean, it was like the perfect target. And when they got there, the peer, who the elders, they said, you know, this is our school, and if anybody throws a stone here, we're going to kill you, and because this school belongs to us. And again, it's the local
ownership. But Greg, I want to ask you about your work with the military. You're an NGO, and I know other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have been critical of you for getting too close to the military. There's a fear that, you know, unarmed aid workers, if too closely associated with the military, will be endangered in the field. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, I'll meet with anybody. Anybody wants to talk about how to get education going, whether it's the Taliban, the U.S. military, government officials. We do collaborate also with a lot of NGOs. We also are very clear we have never received $1 of U.S. federal funding.
Even though you've had some pretty big offers. You were at a military meeting, and what happened?
Well, I've been offered money several times by the USAID or the Pentagon. In fact, one time they offered to give us over $2 million, which is a huge amount of money. And I said, well, I don't want it knowing where we wouldn't want the source knowing. And they said, well, we could stage a fictitious donor from Hong Kong, and you could write him a thank you. And but we politely declined the offer. But I think it's important, especially with girls' education, the impact of that does not happen for one or two generations. But some other things that happen with girls' education is the infant mortality drops. The number of live births per female decreases substantially over one generation. The population explosion drops. And Amartya Sen, who's here in Boston,
the Nobel
Harvard,
Prize winner, yep.
He says that investing in girls' education is the single most important investment you can make in a society. Just from my own perspective, too, I see girls, they come home from the marketplace with meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper, and then their mother very carefully unfolds a newspaper and asks them to read the news to her. Also, you'll see girls writing letters to their mother, to their family, because often their maternal ties are severed. And again, what I was mentioning is that women are much less likely to condone their son to get into violence or terrorism if they do have an education. Yeah. Also, you know, why not let the Taliban be a political entity? They would lose their clout very quickly.
So another of your suggestions is to let the Taliban run as a political party and move them from maybe a violent insurgent group. But also, what? To staying with the schools, what would you like to see the military do, the military that you're now advising? Should it be the military that takes your model and works with villagers to help them build their own schools?
Well, I don't think the military should be directly hands-on building schools. I think people perceive the military as, you know, soldiers and security, and there should be some differentiation between humanitarian workers and soldiers. On the other hand, in many areas now. In Afghanistan, there is no NGOs working there anymore. There is very few aid workers. And so it's just the military and then a few crazy people like us who are going in those areas. I think military is going to be in Afghanistan at least 10 more years. And what's happening is the number of girls going up in school. And over time, that'll help stabilize the region more. And the immediate solution, though, is not an immediate deployment of 20 or 30,000 Marines troops. That'll only escalate the violence. The real enemy, it's ignorance, and it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And overcome that, I think we need to have courage and compassion. But most of all, I think education is the key.
Today, European Union foreign ministers adopted their toughest ever sanctions against Iran in response to that country's nuclear program. The sanctions include a complete ban on new investment in Iran's oil and gas industry, as well as measures targeted at the financial sector and the Revolutionary Guards. But can these so-called smart sanctions punish a nation's government without punishing its people? The BBC's Jonathan Marcus looks back at the wave of international sanctions on Iran to date.
We are ratcheting up the pressure on the Iranian government for its failure to meet its obligations.
July 2010, President Barack Obama signs into law a new round of U.S. sanctions against Iran, intended to turn the screw and bolster the existing United Nations-backed measures.
I'm pleased to sign into law the toughest sanctions against Iran ever passed by the United States Congress, the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act.
But for all the pressure, Iran has shown little sign of abandoning its nuclear program. So have sanctions ever worked in the past? Most experts say that they are an uncertain tool at best. They played a part in bringing about change in the former Rhodesia and in South Africa, but they were only one factor among many. And there are other problems with sanctions too. As Ambassador Nicholas Burns, America's top professional diplomat in the Bush administration, explains.
In the case of Iran, well, there are four UN Security Council sanctions resolutions since December 2006, and their most distinguishing feature is they have not been universally applied. Many, many countries are effectively ignoring them, or like China, undercutting them. China has become the largest trade partner with Iran since these sanctions have gone into effect. So they're a very difficult and sensitive policy instrument, and there are very few examples looking back over the last 25 to 30 years where sanctions have actually succeeded.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
The air attacks against Iraq's infrastructure exacerbated an already difficult situation, as Professor Joy Gordon of the Global Justice Program at Yale University explains.
What really was devastating, in addition to the sanctions, the bombing strikes in the Persian Gulf War of 1991. The devastation of the infrastructure and then the almost total cutoff of imports and exports meant that Iraq was, in the words of a UN envoy, reduced to a pre-industrial state.
The disproportionate damage to Iraq's civilian population encouraged policymakers to think again about sanctions and how they are applied. Sir Jeremy Greenstock was Britain's ambassador to the United Nations between 1998 and 2003. I asked him what conclusions he took from the Iraq episode.
I drew the lesson that it's all too easy for an absolutely unscrupulous regime to pass on the effects of sanctions onto their own people, and that therefore there is always a downside. The second thing that many of us have observed is that economic sanctions aren't a tool that works quickly. They take a long time. Therefore, we want to try and devise an instrument that gets through to the decision makers at a sharper pace than just the collapse of the total economy from which too many people suffer.
Thus were born smart or targeted sanctions aimed against the rulers rather than the ruled. But is there enough clarity as to what these smart sanctions against Iran are really for? It's something I put to Sir Jeremy Greenstock. Were they seeking to change the Iranian government's behaviour on the nuclear issue? Were they about isolating Iran? Or maybe was the idea to change the regime in Tehran altogether?
Well, perhaps all of those things, but there's no doubt in the minds of everybody involved with this that sanctions are a blunt instrument. They're there because words aren't enough and rulers in certain countries don't pay attention to words, and because military action has so many downsides.
It's by no means clear that smarter sanctions are necessarily smarter. They may take even longer to work, and over time they may still involve considerable damage to a country's wider economy. In the past, sanctions on their own have achieved little, but between words and warfare, there may indeed be little else.
That report from the BBC's Jonathan Marcus. Your thoughts? Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. As crews in the Gulf of Mexico get back to work to permanently seal BP's well after last week's storm evacuation, suggestions continue to pour in on preventing future disasters, with much of the focus on new regulations. The Obama administration is working to restructure the Minerals Management Service. There's also been talk of giving the Coast Guard and the EPA more oversight of offshore drilling. But our next guest says in addition to sticks, regulation, there should be more carrots. In the past, there were attempts to reward companies for crafting safety plans that went beyond regulations, but critics say they gave polluters too much control. So let's take a look. Jody Freeman is a professor at Harvard Law School. She was a White House advisor on energy and climate change in 2009 and 10. Professor Freeman, explain your thinking. More rewards instead of just punishments?
Well, I want to just be clear that I believe in strict regulation, but I think we ought to complement those sticks with the kind of incentives that will create an internal drive toward better safety so that the company really starts to embed managing for safety into their operations.
You say, on the contrary, the current system actually at times encourages more dangerous drilling?
Yeah, I think people might be surprised to know that the existing law and the existing incentives actually promote risk-taking, drill deeper, and you get a reward. And actually, we ought to be doing the reverse.
Well, explain how that works. This is the Deepwater Royalty Relief Act. It has expired, hasn't it?
Yes. The initial law passed in the Clinton administration in 95 basically allowed a variety of leases, oil and gas leases, in deeper water to pay fewer royalties into the U.S. Treasury, creating a real incentive to drill deeper and take more risks. And those leases were between 96 and 2000, so it's expired, but there are a number of other programs that pretty much keep a similar set of incentives in place. The Government Accountability Office most recently projected they think that up to $60 billion in royalties may have been foregone because of these incentives. And the point of them at the time was to create kind of motivation for companies to go drill where it was risky, where it was costly to explore and develop resources. And that made some sense then when oil and gas prices were lower. But now production has grown. Oil and gas prices have risen far above 95 levels. So there really isn't a good justification for leaving these kind of incentives in place. And we ought to be doing the opposite. We ought to be finding rewards to take extra safety precautions.
Well, explain further how that would work. In other words, if somebody has a good safety record?
Sure. I mean, think about how it could work if you pay fewer royalties if you happen to be a good performer. Or let's say you put in place an extra blowout preventer as a backup system. Those kinds of things ought to factor into royalty relief. We ought to set up a system that if you're faster and better and safer, we ought to say, we're going to accelerate your permit and have fewer hoops for you to jump through if you show us a really strong safety record.
Well, there are people who defend the current thinking. Jack Girard is president of the American Petroleum Institute. No surprise, he defends this idea of oil companies having to pay less to lease these deep water drilling areas because he says this created thousands of jobs and encouraged, as you said, oil and gas production in places that were prohibitively expensive. It's very expensive for the oil companies to go out there. And we all know they're being chased out of a lot of backyards elsewhere.
Well, it also contributed to the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. And it's true that oil and gas drilling is crucial to the economy of the Gulf. And I think it would be politically very, very difficult to actually try to shut down oil and gas drilling entirely. But I think that we need to think about moving toward cleaner energy, transitioning over time. And I think that's a longer-term agenda. In the shorter term, while we keep drilling for oil, we've got to set up the right set of incentives so that we don't get this kind of disaster again.
And you're also calling for more public shaming of oil companies. What do you mean?
It's basically just disclosing information to the public and helping consumers to make better decisions. Why don't we publicize the information we actually have about the safety records and the performance of these companies? Because if they care about public relations, they might care about that.
Well, a couple questions. After your op-ed on this topic appeared in the New York Times, Zeno Vogiatsits of Maryland wrote and said, "When I'm running out of gas, I can't be looking around for the gas station with a good environmental behavior sign. Any sign, particularly the low dollar sign, will do." In other words, public shaming may not work. That's not what they are looking for.
Well, in and of itself, I don't think it does the trick, but I think it can be helpful. It may be true that you always look for the lowest price, especially when you're right out of gas, but sometimes you have a choice, and some consumers may wish to take their business elsewhere.
How do you get around the fact that it's hard for regulators to even understand some of this new technology and some of what's going on? And so the oil companies have been allowed to police themselves. And in fact, you advised Carol Browner, as we said, in 2009 and 10. And she started a program when she was in the EPA under President Clinton that some say allowed energy companies to police themselves because, in fact, they do have the technical expertise, and the thinking was they do the thing that was best for their bottom line.
Well, you're talking about this pilot program, an experiment in the Clinton administration, which was called Project Excel, for Excellence in Leadership. The whole point of that project was to go to companies that were producing air pollution, water pollution, and say, look, we will give you some regulatory flexibility, some relief, if you show us that you've got a better idea than we have and you'll produce superior environmental performance. So I actually think the core idea of Project Excel was very interesting, but it was cut off by the Bush administration in 2003. But I think the core idea there, that we ought to go and work together with the industry and develop regulations that actually do better than the existing regs would require, and they get a reward for it, I think the core idea there is quite promising.
Well, the director of the Environmental Law Clinic at the University of Maryland was the one who wrote that Project XL became a regulatory free-for-all. And, you know, the sense is that if you have the expertise, you're going to be in the oil industry and not in the government, and that it's hard to know what they're doing.
First of all, I don't agree with those criticisms of Excel. It certainly wasn't perfect, but I think there was a core idea there that was worth pursuing. I think you've got a great point about the information is within the industry. They have the technical expertise, and technology is constantly updating, so we're always chasing after it. The regulation is always chasing after it. And I think the way to start solving that problem is to make sure that what companies have in place is the right management systems, decision-making systems, that makes them confront the full cost of the risk they're taking so that they can't decide to not pay attention to it. They have to be subject to independent outside auditing and checking so that they can't just be internally subject to overconfidence and groupthink.
And then, as you say, add to that rewards when they do achieve certain benchmarks.
Yes, absolutely, but not forgetting that we definitely need our sticks in place at the same time.
Jody Freeman, professor at Harvard Law School, also counselor for energy and climate change in the White House in 2009 and 10. Thanks so much, Jody.
Thanks, my pleasure.
1970 was a great year for radio.
The tears of a clown when there's no one around. And if you're wondering what this song is leading to, I want to make it with you. After midnight, we're gonna let it all hang down.
Eric Clapton, before that Bread, Smokey Robinson. And 1970 also had this personal favorite.
Tom, it's a play right on time. I know your part will go fine.
The Only Living Boy in New York. Pretty much a perfect song. So who would dare to cover what Simon and Garfunkel made iconic? Well, someone who also has Grammy Award-winning cred, singer-songwriter Mark Cohn.
Fly down to Mexico. Dun-dun-dun, here I am. The only living boy.
Mark Cohn knows from good songs. He gave us the uber hit Walking in Memphis in 1991.
When I was walking in Memphis,
10 feet off a beer, walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel?
But in his new CD, Listening Booth 1970, Mark Cohn reaches back to the songs that inspired him. And he joins us from the NPR studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Why'd you decide to do this?
Couple of reasons. The most honest one I'll give you first, which is that I love being in the recording studio, but I didn't have 12 songs of my own yet that I loved. So that was number one. I was itching to get back in the studio, but I didn't have an album's worth of material.
Is it particularly hard when you do come up with a song like Walking in Memphis that is like being struck by lightning or something, such a another perfect song?
I've sort of given up that particular ghost, but I just deal, like most songwriters, with the generic dread of writer's block and writing, just how hard it can be to come up with things that don't sound contrived.
Yeah.
The other answer to your question is I did have in the back of my mind for several years now the idea of doing some kind of record where I didn't write the songs. I kind of took my cue over the last couple years when I heard Raising Sand, that great Robert Plant, Alison Krauss record.
Right.
They did this album of songs that, for the most part, neither one of them wrote. And some of the tunes I had known from a long time ago, some of them I didn't. And I just thought it was a fascinating record. And between that and, like, Nick of Time by Bonnie Raitt, which she didn't write most of the tunes on, that was really sort of my jumping-off point to think, you know, you can make a record of songs you didn't write interesting and cohesive.
But unlike, you know, the Bonnie Raitt CD you mentioned, the songs on your new compilation, again, it's called Listening Booth 1970, are so well known. Oh, let's just take Paul McCartney's
right.
Maybe I'm Amazed.
Right.
Baby, I'm amazed the way you love me all the time. Maybe I'm afraid of the way I love you.
People know the song by Paul McCartney. Going into it, what are you thinking?
I'm crazy, number one. My producer and I, John Leventhal, this really brilliant musician, we thought we could also approach this and do things that nobody knew. But in the end, 1970 was such a huge year for me in terms of really the year where I fell in love with albums and singles. I just thought it would be interesting to try to explore if there was a way to approach these things in a fresh way that everyone knew and see if we could get away with it.
Baby, I'm a man. The only woman who could ever help me. Baby, won't you help me understand? Maybe I'm amazed.
To me, that was the fun of making it, finding a new way into these songs that everybody already sort of knows and hopefully likes.
Well, we should say there's a whole audience that may not know them, but yeah, for others, you're thrown back into this time of like, oh yeah, Cat Stevens was once called Cat Stevens.
That's right.
Let's listen to a little of Wild World, written and performed by Cat Stevens in 1977. He converted to Islam. He adopted the name Yusuf Islam. Let's listen to his version and then yours.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild. Hard to get by just upon a smile.
Was he another influence on you, Mark Cohn?
He was. I had a real appreciation for that song in particular, Wild World, because it's this great singer-songwriter, intelligent, literate song with a great story and a killer pop chorus. You know, it's a great, it's just a great, great song.
There are a number of songs you do that others have done as well, which is surprising because at the time you wouldn't think, oh yes, The Letter, that will be the song that everyone will do. But it was written by Wayne Carson Thompson, a hit for the Box Tops in 67, then for Joe Cocker in 1970, and then there's yours. So let's listen to the whole trilogy.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby, wrote me a letter. Where's your love?
got to get back to my baby once more. Anyway,
the first two versions of that song really are sort of rock oriented tracks, and we did this sort of late night, almost jazzy shuffle kind of thing to it. And I like the fact that it really is quite different than the other two. My baby wrote me a letter. Some of the songs that ended up working were never what I would have thought, and then some of the ones I really would have loved to have done, we couldn't find a fresh way in. And one of my favorite albums from 1970, in fact, maybe the album that made me sort of fall in love with the idea of being a songwriter, was Neil Young's record After the Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, we tried three or four songs from that album, and it just couldn't be done. There was just no way to do anything from that record. And then again, you know, we did do some iconic songs that did work. Really, the only factor for us was finding a fresh, interesting way that I sounded good singing as well.
And so we get to hear your voice again. And I'm just wondering if, you know, hanging out in, Tears of a Clown or After Midnight real estate, you know, maybe will help you find that Walking in Memphis place. Because, you know, again, yours is up there.
Well, it's sweet of you to say. That's my hope. from your mouth to God's ears. That was part of the motivation for me to sort of creep inside and see how these writers have done it. And man, they're just such amazing songs. I would hope that some of it rubs off. That would be great.
Mark Cohn, his new CD is Listening Booth 1970. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We were born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was worn as we sail into the misty. Hark now, hear the sailors cry. Smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the misty. That foghorn blows, I will be coming home. When that foghorn whistle blows, I want to hear it. I don't have to feel it. And now I want to rock your gypsy soul, just like way back in the day. Together we will float.